This is Audible.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled Stress and Your Body. Your lecturer is Dr. Robert Sapolsky. Dr. Sapolsky holds the John A. and Cynthia Frygun Professorship of Biological Sciences at Stanford University, where he is also professor of neurology and neurosurgery. His laboratory focuses on the mechanisms by which stress and stress hormones can damage the brain and on the development of gene therapy strategies to save neurons from neurological insults. Professor Sapolsky received an AB summa cum laude in biological anthropology from Harvard University and earned his PhD in neuroendocrinology from the Rockefeller University in New York. He is also a research associate at the Institute of Primate Research, operated by the National Museums of Kenya in Nairobi, and has spent most of his summers since the late 1970s studying stress vulnerability in a population of wild baboons in East Africa. Professor Sapolsky has been the recipient of many awards for his work, including a 2009 Walter J. Gores Award for Excellence in Teaching, Stanford University's highest teaching honor. He was a 1987 recipient of the prestigious MacArthur Genius Fellowship. Dr. Sapolsky is the author of several books, including Stress, the Aging Brain and the Mechanisms of Neuron Death, The Trouble with Testosterone, and Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, A Guide to Stress, Stress-Related Diseases, and Coping, which was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Award. He also regularly contributes to magazines and journals such as Discover, Science, Scientific American, Harper's, and The New Yorker. The course guidebook that comes with these lectures includes lecture guides, a glossary, and a bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to review these materials before or after each lecture. Lecture 1. Why don't zebras get ulcers? Why do we?
Here's the scenario. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. You're lying in bed, wide awake. Tomorrow is a hugely important day. There's some meeting, some presentation, something where it is all on the line that you need to be coherent, you need to be organized, you need to be alert, you need to be rested. And you are lying there thinking, unless I fall asleep in the next 30 seconds, my entire career is over with tomorrow, and thus you lie there more and more awake. And somewhere about 45 minutes into that worrying, a different worry creeps in. Somehow, amid all of that worrying about your neuroses and sort of those fears of work tomorrow, suddenly it strikes you, oh my God, that pain in the side I've been having, that headache I've been having, I'm sick, I have a fatal disease. It's all over with, it's not fair, I'm too young, all of that. You suddenly have a fatal disease. When it's 2 in the morning and I'm getting all crazy like that, it's always a brain tumor. Because with a brain tumor, you can always panic yourself even more because you can attribute any symptom to that. Maybe you're lying there thinking it's a heart attack or a stroke or some such thing. I'm willing to make a bet, though. You are not lying there thinking, oh my God, this time it's smallpox, or this time it's dysentery for sure, or I can just feel them. I've got liver parasites the size of my fists crawling around in me. You're not going to be worrying about something like that. And in that regard, you are not a normal mammal. You take a normal mammal and you look at the diseases that do them in, and it's ones where there's an acute challenge to your health. It is something major and serious. And what are we doing there? We're worrying about circumstances that slowly do us in. And this is how we humans, especially we westernized humans, differ critically than animals out there. For most of the beasts on this planet, you look at what gets them sick and it is an acute crisis. You are some zebra and a lion has leapt out and ripped your stomach open, your innards are dragging in the dust, and you still need to get out of there. And what do we do instead? We worry about sort of physiological states. We worry about our body slowly going to hell on us over the course of 75 years. And this is a very different realm of disease. For the most part, we are spared the infectious diseases, the diseases of poor hygiene, poor nutrition, and instead we have these diseases where you slowly fall apart over time. And this is westernized disease. And this is a very different realm of who gets sick and who is healthy. 1900, what were the leading causes of death in the United States? All sorts of things we don't worry too much about anymore. Pneumonia, tuberculosis. If you were a woman between ages 20 and 40, the single medically riskiest thing you could do was try to give birth. Number one killer of women in that range. And what was number one on the list as a whole? Influenza, the flu. 1918, worst winter of World War I, people being blown out of trenches all over Europe. And if you were sent to the war that winter, so your chances of surviving were better than if you came down with a flu. 8 million war deaths in World War I, best estimates 40 million dead civilians from the flu. The flu, we don't worry about the flu anymore. Instead, we worry about these diseases where we slowly accumulate damage. And these diseases, like heart disease, like stroke, things of that sort. And this, again, is a very different realm of who is healthy and who's sick. 20,000 years ago, you're some 20-year-old hunter-gatherer, and you have screwed up, you have made a major medical mistake, you've eaten some reed buck riddled with anthrax. And the medical outcome's absolutely clear, you've got like a 2-day life expectancy. These days, you're a 20-year-old and you've screwed up big time because you've decided a healthy diet consists of a lot of red meat or saturated fats or cholesterol, and it's not at all clear what the medical outcome's going to be. You may be dead in your grave when you're 50, or you may be running marathons with your grandkids when you're 85. And in lots of ways, the central question in westernized disease these days is, why do some of us live to 50 and some of us to 85? Now, some of that has to do with, you know, nuts and bolts biology, what your liver does with cholesterol, things of that. But a lot of it has to do with issues that nobody in medicine had to think much about before. Utterly bizarre questions like, what's your social status? Or how do people with your social status get treated in your society? What's your psychological makeup? Even something as bizarre as, so do you eat a lot more carbohydrates when you're feeling unloved? Figure that one out and you've just solved half the cases of diabetes in this country. Whoa, that is a very different realm of who is healthy and who is sick. And when you look at the diseases that get us sick these days, those diseases of slow accumulation over time, these are predominantly diseases that are sensitive to stress. And most of us will have the profound westernized luxury of dropping dead someday of a stress-related disease. My name's Robert Sapolsky. I'm a professor of neuroscience at Stanford, and I'm the messenger with all this bad news. And the strategy in this course is going to be to get a sense of how does stress impact our lives, how does stress impact our health, and not just any kind of stress, the psychological, the psychosocial stress that we westernized humans specialize in. Okay, so much of the course is going to be devoted to that, and I need to warn you right now, the fine print, if you stay awake to the end of that section, you are going to be depressed as hell, because there's nothing but bad news between now and then. What we will transition to towards the end of the course is some realms for good news. Coping, and why do some of us cope better than others? Okay, so stress. Of course, we need to start off with some definitions. And I start off with a term, I guarantee you had it back in ninth grade biology. With any luck, you haven't thought about it since then. Remember the word homeostasis. Homeostasis, an ideal body temperature, an ideal level of glucose in your bloodstream, an ideal everything. A stressor is anything that knocks you out of homeostatic balance. And again, you're that zebra and your innards are dragging in the dust, and this counts as being knocked out of homeostatic balance. Or you're that lion who's half starved to death, and if you don't manage to chase down that zebra, you're not going to survive the night. Short-term physical crisis. And the stress response, you secrete adrenaline and 11D other hormones we'll be learning about, the stress response is what you do to reestablish homeostasis. Now, if you're a zebra or a lion, that's all you need to know about the subject. If you're human, though, you've got to expand the definition in a critical way, which is, yes, stress can be when you're knocked out of homeostatic balance. In addition, a stressor can be when you think you're just about to be knocked out of homeostatic balance. And if you're right, hooray for you, you've got this anticipatory stress response that could be very adaptive. On the other hand, if you think you're just about to be knocked out of homeostatic balance, and you're really not, and you think that way all the time, there are medical ways to describe you. You are being neurotic as hell. You are being anxious. You are being paranoid. You are being hostile. You are being profoundly human. Sit down a hippo and try to explain traffic jams, and it's going to have no idea what you're talking about. But we do. And that's the critical point of the whole field of stress and disease. We turn on the exact same stress response as do those mammals running for their lives or running for a meal, and we turn it on for psychological reasons. For 99% of the beasts on this planet out there, stress consists of 3 minutes of screaming terror in the savanna, after which it's either over with or you're over with. And what do? We turn on the same exact stress response for a 30-year mortgage. And that's not what the system evolved for. And the central concept of this whole course is we humans are smart enough to turn on the stress response, what you'll learn about, to activate the same stress response as does an animal having a physical crisis, and we turn it on for thoughts, for memories, for things of that sort. Okay, here's an exercise. I want all of you to do this. Tonight, when you're in bed, you're nice and relaxed, you're calm, your heart's beating slowly, think the following thought. You know, that heart isn't going to beat forever. I mean, really think about it. Think about the blood flow stopping in your bloodstream. Think about your toes becoming cold. Think about those blue lips. And I'm willing to bet suddenly your heart is beating faster. You won't have just run up some flight of stairs with a cow on your back. You won't be doing anything that counts as a physical stressor. Yet you will be lying there with your stress response activated. And that's the key point. We smart humans activate that stress response for reasons of psychological factors, thoughts, emotions, memories, and that's simply not what the system evolved for. And if you do that chronically, you're going to get sick. Okay, so this is the corner piece of the stress response. And this is an idea that's dominated the field since the 1930s. And has much to do with one of the godfathers of stress physiology, an Austrian physician named Hans Selye. And Selye kind of was the locomotive for the stress field. Selye was able to get the whole thing going because he was very smart, and he was very intuitive, and he was very creative and very insightful. And apparently, he was totally lame at handling laboratory rats. And this is how the field began. Okay, 1930s, Selye is this young assistant professor at McGill University in Montreal, and he's looking for some research project, and some biochemist down the hall has just isolated some unknown hormone out of ovaries or something. Nobody knows what the stuff does. So Selye decides, that's it. I'm going to figure out the effects of this ovarian stuff on the body. So what do? You go down the hall, you get a bucket load of the stuff from your buddy, and you come back, and you start injecting lab rats with it. And apparently, Selye simply was not very good with lab rats. So he's in there every day with the rats, injecting the rats, and dropping the rats, and chasing the rats, and the rats chasing him, and half the morning with a broom underneath the refrigerator trying to get him out of there. Months go by, and Selye examines these rats, and he discovers something amazing. All of the rats have stomach ulcers. Selye is euphoric. He has just discovered the effects of this ovarian stuff on the body. It gives you a peptic ulcer. Now, Selye, being a good scientist, does something critical. He's also been running a control group. a control group of rats he's been injecting with, not the ovarian stuff, but with just saline. So he's been in there with the control rats, injecting the rats and dropping the rats and chasing the rats, rats chasing him. He checks them out and they all have stomach ulcers. Now, your average scientist might give up at this point and, you know, apply to business school, but Selye is thinking about this, and he says, this is totally screwed. I'm seeing the same thing in the controls and the experimentals. This can't have anything to do with this ovarian stuff. What do they have in common? Let's see. Well, I'm pretty inept at handling lab rats. Maybe what I'm seeing is some sort of generalized response of the body to generalized unpleasantries. And Selye's critical insight there was to begin to systematically expose rats to generalized unpleasantries. He'd put some of them up on the roof of the building in the winter, or down in the boiler rooms, or rooms with loud noises, or rooms with cats, and he'd always see the same thing, which is they'd get a stomach ulcer. We know exactly what Selye had discovered. This is the tip of the iceberg of stress-related disease. And Selye was the person who popularized the term, this obscure term for metallurgy, talking about torsional strains on metal. He's the person who popularized this notion of these animals are under stress. Okay, important historical qualifier. Selye spent an awful lot of his life to great acclaim and sort of pulling in crowds, claiming he invented the term stress as related to medicine. No, this was actually done by a giant of stress physiology in the 1920s, a man named Walter Cannon, who was one of those, you know, titans where he just begs to be turned into an oil painting. Cannon was the one who first introduced the term to medicine. Selye was the one who popularized it. And what he would say is, here's these rats undergoing these generalized unpleasantries, these rats undergoing stress, and there's this stress response in the body that helps them adapt to it. But if that stress response is turned on for too long, you're going to get sick. And without question, everybody in the field thought that Selye was out of his mind. For this very simple reason, if you were trained in learning how the body works, there's this rule. The body comes up with a very specific solution to a very specific challenge. If you're hot, you don't shiver. You do something very different from that. Yet here's Selye with his imaginary stress response, which you're supposedly turning on whether you are that zebra, that lion, too hot, too cold. You have this stereotype, this consistent stress response. Nonetheless, this actually makes a lot of sense. Because whether you are that lion or that zebra, if you are going to survive this short-term crisis, there's very similar things you're going to need to do with your body. First off, above all else, whether you are that zebra or that lion, you need energy. Not energy tucked away in your fat cells for some building project next spring. Energy right now in the circulation to hand over to whichever muscles are going to save your life. And the first thing your body does with the onset of stress is you send these hormones to your fat cells, your liver, storage sites throughout the body, and you empty them out of the storage forms of energy. You go to the bank, you empty out the savings account, and you turn it into cash, glucose in the bloodstream. So that makes perfect sense whether you were that zebra or that lion. The next thing you do makes perfect sense as well. You've just done all this amazing biochemistry and dumped all this energy in this easily usable form in your circulation. You want to deliver this stuff as quickly as possible. What do? You increase your heart rate, your blood pressure, your breathing rate, all as part of the strategy. Get that glucose, get that oxygen to your thigh muscles in 2 seconds instead of three. You're that much more likely to survive. Now, another thing that bodies do during stress, and again, this makes perfect sense whether you are that zebra or that lion, is you turn off all the long-term building projects. You do it later under more auspicious circumstances. You shut down digestion. By definition, that starving lion is not just staggering up from some all-you-can-eat buffet, and that zebra is not mobilizing energy thanks to digestion. Mobilizing energy, you do it from your fat cells in a couple of seconds. Digestion takes hours, this slow, expensive process. Humans use like 20% of their energy just on digestion, and this is no time for it. You shut down the digestive tract. And we all know the first step of this. Suppose you're speaking in public and you get stressed. What happens? Your mouth gets dry. And that's the first step of shutting down your whole gastrointestinal system. What else do you shut down? You shut down growth. You shut down reproduction. Perfectly logical. These are big, expensive, optimistic things to be doing with your body, and this is no time for it. You're running for your life. There's a lion two steps behind you. You know, ovulate some other time. Hit puberty next week, grow antlers some other day, don't even think about sperm. And a hallmark of the stress response is you shut down secretion of growth hormone, growth, tissue repair, all of that gets turned off. Every sex hormone on earth begins to disappear from the bloodstream. Do it later if there is a later. Now, the next thing you do makes perfect sense. If you are that zebra in great pain, your innards are dragging in the dust, this might be a good time to perk up your immune system a little bit, protect you against infections. With the onset of stress, immunity is enhanced. Something else useful, you're bleeding like mad, that zebra, might be a good time to get clotting enhanced in your body to try to stanch that blood flow. Now, something else makes a great deal of sense there also. You're that zebra, your guts are ripped open. This is rather painful. And one of the other things that happens during the stress response is you blunt pain perception, stress-induced analgesia. So all of those are good things. Now, in addition, there's a bunch of stress hormones that get into your brain, and short-term, they do fabulous stuff for brain functioning. They increase the delivery of oxygen and glucose to your brain, and that's in part from that increased blood pressure and diverting energy and blood flow to where it's needed, your brain, the exercising muscle. Short-term, you're learning and memory and recall is enhanced. You have that momentness, that alert instant there where you just are in this tunnel of concentration dealing with that stressor. You will remember it. That's the flashbulb memory. I am willing to bet every single one of us, no matter how old we wind up being, we will remember exactly where we were when we heard the news that Angelina Jolie was being appointed to the Supreme Court. This is an important thing. You know, the teaching company recommended I not talk about something topical because it may become obsolete. This is something that will persist through the ages. This will become part of our cultural legacy. Your brain needs to work better at those times. So look at all the things you're doing here. You're mobilizing energy. You're delivering it where it's needed. You're shutting off unessentials. You're thinking more clearly. You're enhancing immune defenses. You are trying to blunt pain. All the sorts of things you would want to do if you are your normal mammal who has just had some sort of physical injury. And all you need to do to appreciate that is look at a couple of rare human diseases where people can't turn on the stress response, can't do all the things we just went over. One of them is called Addison's disease, another is Scheidegger syndrome. These are not diseases where, ooh, now you're more at risk for diabetes. These are diseases where the guy goes running for the commuter bus and drops dead from hypoglycemic shock. So if you plan to get stressed like a normal mammal, if you plan to sprint across the savannah or sprint across a parking lot, you had better turn on the stress response that was just outlined, or else you've got like a 30-second life expectancy. So we've got a first critical punchline here, which is if you plan to get stressed like a normal mammal, you had better turn on the stress response. For most of us, though, the critical issue is, so what if you turn the stress response on too often, too long for purely psychological reasons, and you're going to get sick? Now, Selye, 70 years ago, was the first person to wrestle with this notion, why is it that chronic stress makes you sick? And he came up with an explanation which dominated the field for the next 40 years, which is too bad because he was totally wrong. Here's what he thought. Along comes a stressor, knocks you out of homeostatic balance, you turn on the stress response, and you reestablish homeostasis. Everything's great, except the stressor goes on for too long, and you enter what Selye called the exhaustion phase. You run out of the stress response. Your adrenals run out of adrenaline. Your pituitary runs out of its pituitary hormones. You are left there in a state where you can't battle whatever the stressor is. Turns out this like never happens. Nobody has ever been so stressed that they run out of adrenaline. The problem isn't that you are just exhausting yourself fighting against the stress. The problem is the central point of this whole field. The problem is that after a while, your stress response is more damaging than the stressor itself, especially if you know, the stressor was some psychological nonsense you made up. Everything you're doing with your body here that we just outlined, everything is inefficient and bad news and penny-wise and dollar foolish. But you got to do it because today's an emergency. And for psychological reasons, every day is an emergency. You never fix, you never grow, you never plan for the future. Okay, here's a way to think about it. You've got two kids in the park, and they're on a seesaw, and they're perfectly happy going back and forth, and, you know, they're having a great time, and they're giggling, and they forgot that they lost their gloves, and mom's taking pictures, and all of that. Along comes a change. This is a basal unstressed state. Along comes an acute stressor. You tell the kids, okay, try to balance both of you up in the air for as long as possible. And, you know, the kids are somewhat successful. They could manage it, and it's just fine. This is your body dealing with a short-term stressor. Instead, along comes chronic stress. And the way to think about it now is you don't have two little kids on the seesaw anymore. You've got two huge elephants who you've just told balance the seesaw up in the air. This is not going to work very readily. For one thing, you're going to pay a price. The elephants could be doing something useful at the time. They could be off painting your house or mowing the lawn. They could be off helping the process of building, repairing, and instead, they're devoting all their energy to pulling off this balancing act. Now, there's more problems as well, which is the elephants are going to make a mess of the environment around them. They're going to be, you know, tossing Twinkie wrappers everywhere because they need to, you know, snack nonstop. They'll have stomped down the flowers getting over to the seesaw. They will be causing a lot of wear and tear on your system as a whole. Now, there's an additional sort of subtle price that they wind up having under those circumstances, which is at some point you tell the elephants, that's great, no more balancing, that was terrific, good going, and they've got to get off the seesaw. And as we well know, if you get the timing wrong, somebody will crash down. What we have here is this choreography problem of the elephants getting off at the same time so that they don't break the seesaw and one of them doesn't smash to the ground. You have a problem that will run through the world of stress-related disease, which is it can often be very tough to recover from your stress response. Now, by the way, I was at some conference years ago where sort of people came up with this analogy for the elephants, and we like spent hours working on this. And before you knew it, like half of Earth's stress physiologists who were locked in this room, we were talking about, you know, metaphors of elephants on pogo sticks or sumo wrestlers on seesaws. Nonetheless, you get the point. When you chronically turn on the stress response, you're ignoring repair, planning for the future. When you chronically turn on the stress response, you've got wear and tear on that seesaw and everything around you, and then you've got this big challenge of how do you recover afterward? And this is what chronic stress is about. And we've got this critical issue, that same stress response that was wonderfully adaptive and logical for that zebra or lion. Do it chronically, and you pay a price. One example of the many we will be learning about in far more detail. Okay, you have increased your blood pressure because you're sprinting for your life, and the lion's coming after you, and, you know, you don't suffer from hypertension under that circumstance. You are doing something very adaptive. On the other hand, if you boost up your blood pressure all the time because of the traffic jams, things of that sort, you are not saving your life. You are suffering from stress-induced hypertension. And over, we are going to be dealing with this basic dichotomy here that's going to run through the entire course. If you plan to get stressed like a normal mammal, punchline number one, you had better turn on the stress response. And if you get stressed like a psychosocially sophisticated human, you are constantly going to be paying the price of chronic activation of the stress response, chronic activation of a system that simply did not evolve for being chronically activated. So this is going to be the strategy of the course. What we're going to do over the next couple of lectures is get a sense of what are the nuts and bolts of the stress response? Which hormones are you secreting? Which physiological systems in your body are you turning off? This will give us the tools for the rest of the course. What we'll transition to then afterward is looking at specific systems. What happens with your body during stress with growth and tissue repair, with digestion, with reproductive function, always dealing with this dichotomy. What's the short-term response like when you're a zebra or a lion, and what's the price we're paying when you turn it on like a sophisticated human? Now, a couple of qualifiers have to kick in here. First one is that this is not the case of stress causing heart disease, of stress causing diabetes. What we will see over and over is stress is not a causative factor. Stress is an exacerbative factor. It makes pre-existing disease worse. It lowers the threshold for you coming down with some disease that's already menacing you. What stress does is put you on the edge of a cliff, and almost anything comes along at that point and pushes you, you're that much more likely to go over the edge. So not the sort of thing that mainstream medicine hated about the stress concept early on, the notion of stress causing disease. No, viruses cause disease, bacteria cause disease, mutations, diet, all of that. Stress worsens it. Now, another qualifier that's going to run through here, which is that homeostasis concept has been replaced in recent years with something much fancier, the allostasis concept. What that basically saying is when you're trying to solve a homeostatic challenge, a stressor, you don't solve it just locally. The homeostatic concept is you're running out of water, you're dehydrated. What do? Your kidneys retain water. The allostatic concept brings in a far more realistic picture. What happens instead? Yes, your kidneys retain more water, but you also change how your sweat glands are working. You begin to crave water. What allostasis is about is this notion of the whole body being involved in adaptive responses. And what we'll see is the fact that the whole body is involved increases the odds that one of those adaptations somewhere along the way is going to be getting you in trouble. Couple more qualifiers. If you have a background in this area, you will be horrified by the simplifications I'll be making. Nonetheless, that's necessary. Some of the time because it's impossible to go over the details within this time frame. Some of the time because no one in their right mind wants to learn it unless they're staking their career on it. Some of the time because nobody really knows how it works, especially me. So we will be doing a lot of simplification along the way. So again, this large strategy, what your body is doing with an acute stressor, how great that is, what your body is doing along the lines of falling apart with chronic stress, and throughout we will have this challenge which is hanging on with all this bad news up through 3/4 of this course, hanging on because the main point here is there's good news at the end.
Lecture 2, The Nuts and Bolts of the Stress Response.
Hello. Perhaps you have been listening to Wagner with great pleasure for the last 30 seconds. However, fortunately, I have not been. I've had these earphones on where I've been listening to the theme song from Gilligan's Island, and that's great because I hate Wagner. I cannot stand Wagner. Listening to Wagner elevates my blood pressure and constricts my stomach, and I can't stand the guy's music. And maybe you've been having a different response. Maybe inexplicably, Wagner makes you feel at one with the world, and maybe it slows down your heart rate and your breathing rate. Maybe you've increased your blood flow to your genitals if you're really weird. Maybe, nonetheless, despite you perhaps liking Wagner and having all those responses and me loathing the guy's music, we have one thing in common, which is stuff is changing in our bodies. different processes have changed. All sorts of things are working differently for a very simple reason. We've thought something. We've had some emotion. And we're suddenly dealing with this extraordinary fact, first emphasized in the last lecture, which is we humans are unique, are sophisticated enough that we could think of things, we could remember something from our childhood, we can feel an emotion evoked by a piece of music, we can do any of that, and we could change how our body works. Wonderful example of this. Now, there's been a lot made by gerontologists about this very striking fact of all sorts of orchestral conductors who live to be 120 and they're conducting way up to the end. And what's the explanation? One of the things that's emphasized is all the aerobic exercise you get conducting and that increasing your heart rate to an optimal range. Wonderful story. Apparently, a study was once done on Arturo Toscanini and who was a great example of one of those lasting forever conductors, and where he was not getting all this aerobic exercise conducting. Instead, he was sitting and listening to one of his recordings, and his heart rate increased to the same extent as if he was conducting himself. What we've got here is a very dramatic example that have a thought, have an emotion, have a memory, and things change in your body. Your pancreas releases some hormone you've never even heard of. Your spleen is texting your thymus. Something's happening with blood flow in your big right toe. And what we have is this critical point that runs through everything coming following this, which is we have this capacity, again, as these sophisticated psychosocial humans, to turn on physiology with mere thought. So the question becomes, how do we do that? And broadly, there's two systems in the body responsible for it. The first, the nervous system, the way in which your brain can influence events throughout your body by way of the nervous system. The second, by way of hormones, the release of hormonal messengers. And what this lecture is about is getting a broad sense about how these two systems work, how they're regulated, and most importantly, what happens with these systems during stress. So to begin, that nervous system, that neural regulation by your brain of events throughout your body. To do this, you gotta have a spinal cord. Now, most of your spine mediates boring stuff. It makes you sign checks and, shake hands and foxtrot and all sorts of things that you have voluntary control over. Where you were sending messages from your brain to your voluntary muscles, a system called, not shockingly, the voluntary nervous system. That's not the one that's critical for this lecture. Instead, we have a part of the nervous system that does the good stuff, the stuff you normally don't have much control over. Blushing and goose flesh and orgasms and pupillary contractions, the things that are typically automatic. And thus termed the automatic nervous system, or more formally, the autonomic nervous system. This is the means by which your nervous system changes events throughout your body by way of your spinal cord. Now, this autonomic nervous system comes in two halves, and that's going to be critical throughout the course as well. Two halves. First half, sympathetic nervous system. Sympathetic nervous system, all hell breaking loose, emergency, arousal, fight or flight, secreting adrenaline, the whole stress response, all of that, sympathetic arousal. In contrast, you have the second system, the parasympathetic nervous system, which mediates calm vegetative function. Eat a big starchy meal. You turn on the parasympathetic nervous system. Take a nap, you turn on the parasympathetic nervous system. Get disemboweled by a lion, you turn off the parasympathetic nervous system and turn on the sympathetic. For the most part, they work in opposition. And what we will see is stress and the stress response is all about turning on the sympathetic nervous system to an extremely severe extent, screamingly sympathetic tone in your body while turning off the parasympathetic. Now, how do these work? How do these regulate parts of your body? An example, your heart. We already know what the main sort of core of the cardiovascular stress response is about, which is you're that zebra running for your life. You need to increase your blood pressure and your heart rate to deliver more energy to your exercising muscles. So what happens with this autonomic nervous system at the level of your heart? You turn on the sympathetic nervous system and it speeds things up while you're decreasing parasympathetic tone. So in the heart, what the sympathetic nervous system is about is increasing activity. Meanwhile, in the last lecture, we learned another example of what happens in your body, the gastrointestinal tract. You will remember that business, you get stressed, you get nervous, your mouth gets dry, the first step of shutting down the whole gastrointestinal system. And what we've got there is a case where the sympathetic nervous system, the emergency arousal, is decreasing activation of this particular organ. So in order to pull off this emergency stress response business, as we saw before in the previous lecture, some organ systems you activate, some you inhibit, and it's the sympathetic nervous system that's predominantly responsible for this. Okay, so the question, of course, becomes, what regulates the sympathetic nervous system? What are the regulators of this broader autonomic nervous system? Now, there's parts of the brain where you decide voluntarily you're going to wiggle your finger, and there's certain neurons, brain cells that have been identified that do that. What regulates all this stuff where you think about a memory from your childhood and your heart rate changes? What regulates this autonomic nervous system? And to begin to appreciate it, we need to pull in a concept, a wonderful one that has run through sort of the field of behavioral biology for some years, one originated by a man named MacLean, Paul MacLean, one of the giants in the field in the 1950s, what has come to be known as the triune brain. The triune brain, the three-layer version of the brain. Obviously, this is not what the brain is really about, but it's a way to conceptualize what's happening, particularly with respect to the autonomic nervous system. Now, you've got your first level of the triune brain, which is the part of your nervous system that has all these ancient pathways, your hypothalamus, all sorts of brainstem areas. Do not panic if those terms are new to you. The main point there is this is one of the most ancient parts of the brain. This is a part of the brain where, like a lizard, has virtually the same part of the brain there, the same regulatory sub-areas, the same projections. What's this part of the brain about? It's doing regulatory stuff. Your body gets cold, and there are sensors which send information up to this ancient reptilian part of the brain, and suddenly your muscles start shivering. You get some signal sent up there saying, oh, God, I'm bleeding. And before you know it, there are signals coming down, changing your cardiovascular tone, exactly the same in us as in a reptile. So we've got this first part of this triune brain way of thinking about the nervous system. Second layer, the limbic system. On top of the triune sort of reptilian section, limbic system. Limbic system is about emotion. Limbic system is about lust and rage and petulance and all that stuff. Limbic system is about mammals. Yeah, reptiles have a limbic system, fish, all those guys, but they don't have much of one. I mean, lizards are not renowned for their emotional lives. It's not till mammals that you get a really well-developed limbic system. And what's that doing? That's the, you know, moose that sees some other male moose dominating and trying to come into his territory with his antlers. If, I don't know if moose actually have antlers, but some male doing some territorial threat, and you, the other male, being threatened, your heart rate increases. It is taking information about the world, which is emotional in nature, and turning it into a signal down to that reptilian part of the brain. And suddenly, your heart is beating faster, not because you're running and you're getting signals there, not because you're bleeding, but because you've seen something, you've thought something, you have had a strong emotion evoked. Sitting there on top, though, is the third most layer in this triune organization, the cortex. The cortex, this gleaming new part of the nervous system, the most recently evolved. Yes, once again, reptiles, fish, birds, they have a cortex. It is something that is not really elaborated until you get to mammals and is not really, really elaborated until you get to primates. The cortex is about all that abstract stuff. Abstract reasoning, processing, long-term memories, all of that, and that becomes very pertinent here. Hemorrhage, and thanks to the reptilian brain, you turn on the stress response. See that menacing moose, and thanks to the limbic system, you turn on the stress response. Think about children in refugee camps. Think about ozone layers thinning out. Thinking about your eventual mortality. Thinking about a fictional character who evokes emotions in you. And suddenly, you might turn on the stress response. Suddenly, your cortex does a classically cortical thing, some abstract thought, and suddenly your heart is beating faster. Suddenly your breathing rate may have decreased. Suddenly your salivary glands are doing something different. Suddenly you've regulated your autonomic nervous system. And what that implies is, for one thing, what the cortex has is lots of ways of speaking to the limbic system and speaking to that reptilian part of the brain. You think a thought, and in some ways that reptilian part of the brain reacts as if you're hemorrhaging. Somehow it reacts as if this is a physiologically real event. And you better bet throughout this course, as we deal with us and our stressors, not our stressors being chased by predators, our stressors of psychosocial nature, what we're going to be dealing with is this ability of the cortex to do its abstract sort of thing, and suddenly your body reacts as if it was a real menace. This is another way of stating the central concept of the course. By the time we get to these psychosocially sophisticated humans and primates, we have that ability to change the body's functioning with thought, with emotion, with memory. And if it's the right kind of adverse thought, emotion, memory, and you do it chronically, you will be suffering from the consequences of activating your stress response too often. Now, in a lecture to come, in two, in fact, we will be dealing with one of the more interesting domains of what your cortex can do to the rest of your brain, your cortex thinking about extremely sad things. And suddenly, your body reacts differently. What's the building block we've just seen neuroanatomically? As we will see, this is a lot about what a depression is about. Obviously highly simplified, nonetheless, some sort of a sense of how to begin thinking about how the brain regulates psychosocial manifestations throughout the body. Okay, so that's our first half. Remember, we've got our two halves here. The first one, the nervous system regulating the autonomic, the automatic, the involuntary, the unconscious parts of your body by way of neural projections down your spine, this autonomic nervous system. And as we've heard, there's a second type of regulation, which is by way of hormones. Okay, hormones evoke a whole lot of fancy definitional stuff. Here's a hormone. Here's what it consists of. You've got, for example, a brain cell, a neuron, which dribbles out some chemical messenger. And it goes a thousandth of an inch until it hits the next neuron, and it changes something or other in that neuron's function. What you've got is a neurotransmitter. Now, instead, you have that neuron that secretes, say, the same exact chemical messenger, except this time, instead of going a tiny distance to the next neuron, it gets in the bloodstream, where it can circulate throughout the body and affect something going on in your ankles. And what we've just defined is a hormone. A hormone is a chemical messenger which can come from a brain cell or cells throughout the body, as we'll see, and it is blood-borne, and as a result, it can affect events throughout your body. So, of course, the question becomes, amid all of the hormones that are coming down the pike that we will learn about, and all of their consequences, some of which are bad news in the face of chronic stress, of course, the question now becomes, what regulates hormone release? the same sort of question as what regulates that autonomic nervous system, what regulates hormone release, and figuring out the answer to this has been a great chapter of history of physiology. So what regulates hormone release? Hormones come from glands. That's kind of a definition of a gland. A gland secretes hormones, chemical messengers that get bloodborne. A gland secretes hormones. Glands like ovaries and testes and adrenals and thyroid, that sort of thing. So what tells them when to secrete their particular hormones? And what everyone thought they knew, endlessly, absolute, iconic textbook knowledge was, these glands know what they're doing. These glands are autonomous. These glands themselves decide, when am I going to secrete progesterone? When am I going to secrete thyroid hormone? The glands are self-regulating. The glands somehow know when to do their thing. And this was a dominant model around 1900, and in fact it gave rise to one of the truly weird chapters of endocrine history. And it had to do with aging. Okay, scientists at the time are trying to figure out what aging is about, and they're just figuring out at the time that there's some interesting hormonal stuff that comes out of the testes, testosterone. There's interesting stuff there. I don't think they had quite the term at that point. And the theory became, well, what causes aging? Aging is due to declining levels of testosterone, taking away your vigor. As we'll see, there's two problems to that. One is that this, in fact, is not entirely the case what goes on, and testosterone does not play this role. Second problem is that it ignores aging in like 51% of the population. Oh, those folks without testes. But in any case, this is what all those aging male scientists focused on at the time. So if you believe, number one, that declining testosterone levels with aging have a lot to do with the aging process, number two, that the testes know what they're doing, they decide when to secrete the testosterone, and thus aging testes are not as good as secreting it, you come up with what was state-of-the-art medicine at the time, which is give some guy a new set of testes. And what was done during this magical era of endocrinology is people would have bits of goat testes or monkey testes transplanted, put under their skin, where in the view at the time, the testes would be off and running, these new ones with young, vigorous amounts of testosterone release, and that would just reverse the aging process. This was all the rage. Captains of industry, heads of state, would go off to fancy sanitariums to get themselves their monkey gland extract. This was known as the monkey gland phenomenon because people at the time were not allowed to say outrageous, blasphemous terms like testes, but this was the monkey gland craze. And it turns out that none of this is what was going on because your testes don't know what they're doing, nor do your ovaries, nor do your kidneys or your thyroid or your adrenals. These glands, these peripheral glands, turned out not to be autonomous. In other words, they were not deciding when to secrete their hormones. Someplace else in the body was doing this. And thus we transition to the next level of regulation. Of course, you may ask, why were all of these guys nonetheless, after they were getting their monkey gland transplants, why were they reporting these wondrous effects and rejuvenating? I think what we have is this grand placebo effect. You go to this place, you pay a ton of money, and they transplant all sorts of distressing monkey parts into your butt. You've got a strong incentive at that point to suddenly feel like a young stud again. One big placebo effect. Okay, so the peripheral glands don't know what they're doing. What does? We transition up at this point to the pituitary gland. And by the 1940s, 1950s, what became clear is it was the pituitary secreting its whole array of hormones, which would then go in the bloodstream, and tell the various glands what to do, tell them when to secrete their hormones. And this gave rise to one of the great sound bites of physiology, and this was what the pituitary was. And in fact, I endlessly encountered this, like lots of folks in my generation. I grew up reading the Reader's Digest in the bathroom, and amid all their articles, they had this one continuing series, I am Joe's liver, I am Joe's stomach, I am Joe's heart, I am Joe's ovaries, this whole sort of series of articles they had, and somewhere in there, eventually, you would get the I am Joe's pituitary. and out would come the inevitable soundbite there, which is the pituitary is the master gland. Turns out, the pituitary isn't the master gland. And by the 1950s, top people in the field were realizing the pituitary doesn't know what it's doing on its own. It is not autonomous. It's getting directions from someplace else. And this shifted to what at the time was an outrageous notion, which is the brain is the master gland. The brain is releasing hormones that tell the pituitary what hormones to release, which tell the peripheral glands. This was outrageous at the time because endocrinology had this somewhat sort of lowbrow feel to this. And neurobiologists, brain scientists, did not like the notion one bit that this gleaming, analytical, computer-like brain actually was like drooling hormones out of some gland. This seemed very unappetizing, and it took a huge amount of time for people to actually prove that the brain, specifically the hypothalamus, a part of the brain that sits just above the pituitary, the hypothalamus releases hypothalamic hormones, which tell the pituitary what to do. The search for hypothalamic hormones was this grand, grand race between two individuals, two scientists, one named Andrew Shalley, the other named Roger Guillemin, who started off working together, and presumably one night over the test tubes, one of them made a snide comment about the other one's hairdo or something. They broke up this collaboration and they began one of the great competitions in science, the competition to isolate the first hypothalamic hormones. And it took them years and years and years. And because these imaginary hormones, as far as everybody else was concerned, these imaginary hormones, if they existed, were in such tiny amounts because all they had to do was just go down here and tell the pituitary what it does. All it needed to do was travel a half inch or so, that there wasn't going to be much of the stuff. How do you isolate it? How do you prove the stuff is there? And these guys had to pioneer these approaches of getting thousands of pig hypothalami that they got from stock houses and cow hypothalami, where they would then extract various factors from there and throw them onto pituitaries that were sitting in petri dishes and see if the pituitary suddenly did something different that made sense. Aha, somewhere in this thimble full of stuff we poured in, there's this hypothalamic factor that's relevant. Huge amount of work, all of this competing for who got contracts with which stockyards, grad students in each of the two labs sort of not talking to the ones from the other ones. Huge competition amid this great skepticism as to whether these hypothalamic hormones even existed. And it took them years and decades. And eventually, they showed that the hypothalamus is the master gland. And you better bet the limbic system and the cortex is telling the hypothalamus when to secrete its particular hormones that tell the pituitary what to do, which then tells the peripheral glands. And these two guys got their Nobel Prizes for doing so. And bizarrely, you might ask what would seem to be a simple question is, well, which of them won the race? Which got there first? And it depends on quite how you define winning. And I won't go into the details of that, because whoever I wind up casting a vote for, folks on the other side of the argument will come and stab me for doing so. But this was a major landmark event showing how the brain is the thing that ultimately regulates hormones, the endocrine system. And thus you have what are now termed axes, endocrine axes. You can have the ovarian axis, where the brain secretes a particular hormone, which tells the pituitary to secrete its particular hormone, which goes to the ovaries, and suddenly out comes estrogen. Or you can have the thyroid axis. The brain secretes a different hormone, which gets the pituitary to secrete a different one and gets the thyroid gland to secrete thyroid hormone. These endocrine axes. Okay, so we've got all of this working that way. Mind you, there's a few exceptions. Not all hormones are under the control of the brain, but for our purposes, the hypothalamus to pituitary to peripheral gland sequence is what we will work with. And what we will work with also is that notion of the limbic system and cortex telling the hypothalamus when to secrete its hormones, along with limbic and cortical influences on that autonomic nervous system. So, How do these things wind up working? What you've got are an array of hormones which constitute the stress response and an array of autonomic components. And what we'll go over now is the major players in the stress response. And I cannot possibly emphasize too much at this point. Do not panic. Do not panic when hearing these terms. If they are important, you will hear the names of these hormones a gazillion times in the lectures to come. This is merely just to introduce the first players. Do not even dream of writing them down. So which hormones are secreted during the stress response? We've already heard that the sympathetic nervous system is turned on, and the main hormone that it regulates is adrenaline, also known as epinephrine. In the United States, typically known as epinephrine. In England, Commonwealth countries, is adrenaline. Comes out of the adrenal glands. Sympathetic nervous system sends a message to the adrenals. Out comes adrenaline, epinephrine. Next major player. A class of steroid hormones that come out of the adrenal glands as well, called glucocorticoids. And I happen to be in love with